You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. Yes, it's the rainy season here. This is Colombia Calling, episode 227. We're wading through afternoons of heavy, heavy rain. It's like London or New York, only the pavements don't absorb the rain here, the drains can't take it, and so you're always stepping on these stealth bricks, which then shoot the rainwater up your trouser leg, unless you're wearing boots. But this is the life in the city. This is life in Bogota. But I don't want to digress any further. You know, we've got a very special guest on the show today. I mentioned him in last week's show. Remember when I was talking to Diana Maria Valencia in Exeter in the UK about the elections, and I ended saying that we were going to have Carlos Villalón on the show. He's a Chilean conflict photographer, represented by Redox in New York, but he's been here in Colombia for 18 years. He's seen everything. When we talk about hardcore photojournalism, this is the guy that we think of here in Colombia, because he's embedded himself with the guerrillas. He's been with the paramilitaries in certain places. He, in fact, did the photography of one of the best pieces I read in the last couple of years, when it was the Darien Gap, the migrants from Bangladesh or Benin crossing up through the Darien Gap. It was an Outside magazine, and I think on National Geographic as well, they did something about it. So this guy is, you know, we're talking the real deal. He's going to tell us a little bit, because we've got a project in our hands, and I've got the mashup, the first sort of mashup of this book, and it's called Colca, the Lost War. So it's basically a detail of this, the failed war on drugs, but taking coca from its very start, you know, in Bolivia, Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, as a sacred leaf, the coca leaf, you know, the leaf that then gets made into cocaine. And it ends with pictures in New York's Bronx and so on and so forth, and the down and out underneath the bridges and flyovers in this horrible situation. And this book is coming out. It's now on a Kickstarter campaign. So this is why we've got him on. We're going to talk about it. And you guys out there who are so interested in this are going to pledge money for this book, because it was going to be taken by Random House, who then decided against it because of the dollar and the peso and the change, and you know what the economy is like. But let me stop here and just say welcome, Carlos, on Columbia Calling. Thank you for agreeing to be on the show.
Hey, Richard, how are you doing? Thank you.
Perfect. Now, Carlos, let's start with the first thing. How did you end up in Colombia? I mean, you were in New York for a long time. You came down here on assignment for the conflict or something, and then stayed.
Yeah, exactly. I remember I went to Getty Images in New York. This is like September 2000. I left a portfolio there, and they called me and they said they were interested in the pictures. It was like a potpourri of pictures from Afghanistan, Mexico, Haiti, you know, prior trips. But anyways, they like it, and they say, what you are going to do? And I said, I'd like to go to cover the peace dialogues in Colombia between FARC and the government of Andrés Pastrana.
So we're talking about 98, 2002.
2000.
Yeah, okay.
So basically I came here for a month. Mm-hmm. That was the assignment with Getty. And then the country started to get very interested, especially for the United States, Plan Colombia. And Getty told me if I wanted to stay, I was mostly welcome, because they needed a photographer here. So I stayed working with them for like 2 years.
So it's 18 years later, you're still here. We are glutton for punishment. For some reason or other, we love it here. One of those obvious reasons, there's something so very seductive about Colombia. But so tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing, because I know that you used to go when the FARC was actually, you know, not a political party and was a belligerent, let's say, guerrilla faction. You used to go routinely and embed yourself with them to take photographs. And I mean, there are some, I think, dating back to those days here in this mashup that I've got, in towns in rural Colombia where they negotiate payment with coca. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this was the incredible thing because I arrived to Los Pozos in San Vicente del Gaguay, like the headquarters of the peace dialogue. And really, after 2 days, I saw like nothing was going on. It was just political pictures, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, this is going to be very boring. I don't want to be here. But I had an interest, I don't know why, on the Caguán River. I see the brown waters flowing towards the Amazon. And I had an interest, and I start talking to the guerrillas, the commanders, what was going down there, and if I could go. Basically, they say no, like 3 times I asked. But because of these things of good luck, I got a passage to go there. And the first day I get there, I remember it was like December 5th or something like that, I saw a guy drying cocaine base on a basketball field. And I was like, I can't believe this. And I didn't know what exactly it was. But then I asked the guy, he said, it's cocaine base. And I'm like, no one minds you doing this in the middle of town? And he's like, no, everyone is doing it because the drug dealers or the traffickers are coming today to buy cocaine base. And then I saw these people bartering like a Coca-Cola for a few grams of the base. And I was like, I think I ran into the best ever story in my life. And I did this story for 3 years with the permits of the guerrillas. So I got to know them. I told them exactly, I wasn't interested in photographing them all the time and their camps. I was more interested in the farmers and their economy and this cocaine-based economy. So I think the guerrilla liked a lot that. They let me do it. I became well known in the area by the guerrillas. So after I finished this work, I had the link with the guerrillas and I started to work with them in other parts of the country. So this is how the relation started. It started by something like a social economic story, you know?
It's fascinating how it should come out. So you gain their trust, as I could say here, like confianza. But so how did you do it? I mean, I know that there'll be some fledgling photojournalists or journalists out there listening to this. So what do? Call up a contact, send a message and say, I'm interested in going to your base in Arauca or in Chocó or in Valle, and they then pass the message to Central Command, and then there's like an agreement that comes back and you get a passe, how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, at those times, you know, that it was a super secretive thing, like to meet with the guerrillas. I mean, phones were tapped. It was very dangerous. So basically, you meet someone on the field, you get a phone number, and this is something super secret.
Yeah.
And you use that number to send messages.
Yeah.
You know, another time we set up like an email system that was very funny, and we would like write messages in that account, but we would never send them, so it would stay on the draft. But then the other people had the same password and the same account, so they would go in and they would look at the draft and they would leave a message just on the draft box. So the message would never go. So you just get in, and there were different ways, you know. Sometimes they would call you and say, look, someone needs to talk to you, you gotta be in Llanos del Yari tomorrow, so you got to run, jump on a plane, take cars, motorcycles, and you be there, you know? There were so many different ways to contact these people, as well with the paramilitaries or any other, you know, illegal group.
I'd never heard about that email, just leaving in the draft. That's fascinating. That's
fantastic, really, no? Very clever.
That's very clever indeed. Obviously, over the years, I mean, you must generate a certain degree of paranoia about this. I mean, did you ever get followed, or did you ever have to sort of like abandon a trip?
There's some instance that I thought it was very strange, and it happened here in Bogota. I think I just had published this story, Cocaine Country, in National Geographic. So everyone was frantic, government, police, guerrillas, everyone was like jumping about this story, and it was like the cover of National Geographic with that.
I remember it.
Gorilla girl, super well armed.
2007?
Four.
Okay, 2004.
And Cocaine Country, wide, you know, so it made noise. And someone called me from a radio in Chile, radio station in Chile, to do an interview. So it was a Saturday morning interview. And we talk about, it was Alvaro Uribe's presidency at that time, you know, what it means.
Yeah.
So basically we talk about cocaine, we talk a lot about lots of things, and then the journalist asked me, what do you think of Alvaro Uribe? And I said something like, he's the master of makeup, you know? He does it perfect. And it went on with this, you know, idea. And then interview is over, I'm ready to go to the gym, it's like noon on a Saturday. I go down, you know, my stairs, I open the door, and I see an old guy across the street. Just saw an old guy, no? But I close the door, start walking, and I see this old guy jumping and running across the streets and like confront me. And it's like, hey man, how you doing? Remember me? I'm doing very well. And I'm like, I don't know this guy. I've never seen it in my life. And he's like, yeah, you know, after Caquetá, and I was like, well, Caquetá, I worked 4 years there, so maybe I know him, I forgot. So something, Caquetá, okay. And he's like, yeah, I sold the finca, now I have a finca in Los Llanos, and I'm producing this incredible merchandise, meaning cocaine, you know? And I'm like, well, I'm very glad for you, blah, blah, blah. And then he picks up something from his pocket shirt and hands it to me, and he hands me like a big ball of cocaine. And he's like, here, man, so you can taste the quality. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I, at this point, I'm like, I don't know if I know you already. And he's like, well, you know, you should test this with your friends and share it with your friends. And I'm like, I have this thing in my hand. And I'm like, this is something very wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm like, here, man, I don't do this thing. I don't want to have anything with this thing. And he's like, nah, man, here. And he's like pushing it towards me, like, grab it. And at some point, I'm like, okay, this is it. And I said, look, man, I'm seriously, I want your phone number so I can call you, and I want to see the product in the finca where you work. And here, put it back in his pocket. And he's like, come on, man, don't you want it? Don't you want it? I'm like, dude, this is it. Thank you. I'll call you in a week and I'll go visit you in your farm, no?
Yeah.
I leave. And then, like, 2 minutes after this, I called the number he gave me from, like, a public phone, and the number didn't exist. So I'm like, someone was listening or doing and was trying to set me up.
Is this entrapment there? They catch you with that amount and then they get you out of the country.
No, I'm going 10 years in jail, you know, here in La Picota.
Oy. Oy.
And the journalist who works with the cocaine thing is a drug addict, you know?
Yeah.
I had the feeling, I mean, I never knew what exactly it was, but I had the feeling like my phone was tapped, you know?
That's pretty scary, isn't it? And so, did you get painted, like, let's say, underneath the Uribe government as, like, a guerrilla sympathizer? Did they say that, or, like, you know?
They never said to me directly, but but they knew I was going to the guerrillas, and every time I went to the guerrillas, I got stopped at military checkpoints.
Mm.
And then, I remember a couple of times, maybe near San Vicente del Caguán, like, the Chilean is here, he's back.
Chilean. And so tell us about, just quickly, as we wind down this first segment of the show, I mean, how did you feel the difference of visiting, let's say, a guerrilla encampment to a paramilitary base? How did it differ? I mean, were you, as I asked one journalist who's been to both as well, Matt Charles, from England, and he said he felt more unsafe recently with the ELN than with like some Urabeños, because there was a chain of command. He felt there was more stability, but I think that has to do with the different regions of the country. But when you visit the paramilitaries, are you more ill at ease? Are you less calm? Or
you know, to tell you the truth, really, you know, I never think of these things, but it's like when I was with guerrillas or paramilitaries, I felt exactly the same. Mm. To me, they were Colombians, and once you're invited to their turf, you're super welcome, and you know they're gonna do their best to protect you.
Yeah.
And I felt I was a lot with the Elmer Cardenas block before they demobilized.
Yeah.
And with the FARC a lot, with different fronts. And I was in Santa Fe de Ralito with Tom Bernan.
Yeah.
But in these countries, like in a way like Afghanistan, once you are invited, they're gonna make their best to protect you. And I always felt welcome. And some one point only in Lormiga with the paramilitaries, I think it was like, I forgot the name of that block. But I think someone said something against me. And I was very welcome. I was working with them a lot. And someday I just showed up and the commander is like, man, no more, like leave. I mean, nothing is gonna happen to you. Well, we cannot talk about safety of journalism anymore because of the three journalists that got killed last week here in Colombia. Never happened before. So things are gonna move. But I always felt like paramilitaries, guerrillas are basically young, poor kids that are doing this, you know, for money or for a little conviction, you know, but they're like super cool, like Colombians are, you know.
Yeah.
They're like super welcome.
Yeah, and I think that's it, you know. And I come back to my first experiences in Colombia back in 1998, working for an NGO and traveling the Pacific Coast. It was dangerous. There was no doubt about it. The military scared me more than anyone else, but something kept bringing me back, and I think it's just Colombians, you know, in general speaking. So, I mean, fascinating to talk about this. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk further about Carlos and his time in Colombia, Carlos Villalón, Chilean conflict photographer, and his book, Coca, La Guerra Perdida, or Coca, The Lost War. It is on Kickstarter, so you know, you need to throw some money at this so we get this book out there, because it's important that it's published. Take a look, and of course the links are all on our Facebook page and Twitter, etc. We're all over the social media ills, but we're taking a short break on this episode 227, Columbia Calling. We'll be right back with further anecdotes and further information about this book in this next segment of the show. So thank you for listening. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. As you know, we're here with conflict photographer Carlos Villalón, Chileno. I've been here for 18 years. We're here in his place in the Macarena, which is the Ojo Rojo Fabrica Visual. So it's kind of like a gallery and a launch pad for let's say, indie photography here in Colombia or around the region, because you've had exhibitions of other photographers. And pretty much every month or even every couple of weeks, you have events here that are very cool. Indeed, I've seen Stephen Ferry's La Batea, about his book about artisanal mining. You had something recently about the Bogotazo. And of course, you launched your crowdfunding campaign for Coca, La Guerra Perdida, here, The Lost War, this book that you're working on here in this place. It's very cool. There's a coffee shop with high quality coffee. So I recommend you guys, any of you out there visiting the Macarena, to keep an eye out for events coming on here. Now, obviously, Carlos's crowdfunding campaign is on Kickstarter, so check that out. The link's on our Facebook page. We finished the last segment of this show, and you mentioned this dreadful occurrence that took place, is the murder of three Ecuadorian journalists in Colombia. I guess they were kidnapped within Colombia or just within Ecuador and brought by the dissidents of the FARC. And I wanted to talk about that before we launch a bit more into your book. Do you feel that things are getting worse now for journalists in Colombia in this situation, let's say, with this dissidence of the FARC and the ELN, etc.?
Well, you know, I mean, I never knew of, like, journalists, foreign journalists being killed in Colombia. I mean, lots of local journalists, yes, have been killed, you know. But these three guys, I mean, two journalists, one writer, one photographer, and the other guy was her driver, they were foreigners,
yeah,
basically, if they were killing Colombia. We don't know this. But you know that the fact that the dissidents, the FARC dissidents, killed three journalists, just as they are, like, kind of starting to shape themselves, these groups, because they left the FARC a year ago, you know, so it's a new thing. And if they made the decision to kill these people because the government of Ecuador didn't fulfill the requirements, that was, like, to free some former FARC soldiers. But the fact that they did it so fast and claiming that there was combat and army followed them, and then both presidents in the country says, in Colombia and Ecuador, they say they didn't send any troops. So no, let's say it's true that they didn't send any troops to chase these people. They just was, it was like a cold blood killing, you know? So I think things are gonna start moving around, reshaping, you know, editors after this are gonna be, like, more reluctant to send their people in to cover the region. Me, myself, I never was afraid of going to far places, even if I didn't have a contact or knew a commander, you know. But now I would think twice if I go to the border between Ecuador and Colombia on all this Cocalero region without a contact, just to stop there and wait for them to jump on me and say, who are you?
Yeah.
I'm thinking twice now.
Let's just quickly say, do we think that the dissidents is actually separate from the political FARC, or it remains the FARC politicians' plan B if everything turns to, turns to shit?
Yeah. I mean, if I was a FARC commander or something, I would have the dissidents as my plan B, because my trust on the government is very, very little, you know? So I would have that done, but I don't know what these FARC guys are thinking or how they're doing. I mean, I don't have that a good access.
Yeah, but you're someone who knows this outfit pretty well. If anyone knows it pretty well, you're gonna have an educated best guess. I mean, that's what it is. So let's go back to this book again, available on Kickstarter. What I like most is, I'm flicking through, and you know, we talked off mic for a second here. You follow the lives of some of the children in this book. They start as, like, young children, chopping up the coca on, I guess, a plantation, and you become good friends with their dad, and then later on, that, you know, you run into them again in Yari in 2016, I guess, is it?
So you
followed a whole generation of coca growers. I mean, there's not a lot of people who get this whole, you know, let's say this synchronicity of a story. This is a long-term project. And so what's this guy, this kid that you've got here, like, let's say Paige, whatever, and the father who, you know, in the poverty in their farmhouse, you ran into him and he's now like a 20-year-old guerrilla.
Yeah, it's funny because I knew this guy, Ruben, back in 2000, and I guess he was the one in charge to take me to all the coca fields to talk to the farmers, you know. I thought it was that way, but we became friends and we were hanging for 4 years together. I know his family, I know little kids, you know. And yeah, in fact, that picture, this is like his youngest, probably at that time, 5, 6 year old,
yeah,
you know, playing with the machetes and basically moving a coca plantation to another location after it's being fumigated.
Yeah, you can see the stripped bare trees here. So
they're just taking the stems, you know, and, like, to plant them in another field in the jungle. But then I'm talking, like, I don't know, 10 years later, I ran into this gorilla far checkpoint during the last 10th conference they had in 2016, 2017. And I ran into this gorilla checkpoint and I look at this kid, he looks at me and he's like, I know you, where I know you from? And I'm like, I know you too. And then I remember, I'm like, you are Ruben's son. I haven't seen you like in 15 years. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember you are the Chilean photographer. So we exchange letter, I send a letter to his father, you know, because I really like this guy. And it's so funny, no? How close this world, gorilla world, cocaleros is, you know?
What amazes me is also, well, it shouldn't amaze me, but it's the inevitability that these kids become gorillas. You know, there's nothing else, is there? That's it.
Or you are a cocalero or you are a gorilla.
And that's just the situation. It's still the situation in these far off areas. Inexplicably, the government didn't move in to then, you know, put state presence into these areas after, let's say, the majority of guerrillas turn themselves in, you know, as a result of the peace dialogues. I say it again and again, but it seems inexplicable. But
it's incredibly strange. I mean, you know, I did this story. I mean, this is the reason for why I stay in Colombia. And we're talking about year 2000. Mm-hmm. And people ask me today, is this still going on? Yeah. And it's weird, you know, I mean, this is 2018, and I was in a town in Meta last January, and that cocaine-based bartering is exactly the same, meaning nothing has changed in the countryside in Colombia, you know? And I don't know why the government doesn't do anything about it, you know? I mean, they should move in, bring technology, bring farm tools, bring
schools,
modernity, you know?
Just something, just to show, but it don't do it.
They just leave the door open for the new groups. ELN, paramilitaries, or Urabeños,
or any other, whatever they call themselves now, these offshoots.
They left the door open.
Let's talk, I mean, it's just one of those things that I've been saying until I'm blue in the face this. It's just people ask me, you get people to comment on this. You know, this is an inexplicable situation. And I realize that this stretches the government, but it's a situation where you have to do it. But then I'm on page 84 of your book here, and I'm looking at a picture that to me, you know, first I've seen two women sitting there in what looks like a clinic. And yeah, and they're in a clinic, and there's this sort of Red Cross sign behind it. And then I see something in the foreground out of focus, and it's a bag of coca paste. And you're like, these girls are paying for their checkup with coca paste. Tell us about this story, because there's more to this than meets the eye.
Well, these two girls are prostitutes that they're not from that town, but probably one of them I knew, she was from Medellin. But there's a lot of money here in these towns because of the coca. So lots of women come down from the north of Colombia to work as prostitutes there. And they work in the two bars that are in this town, Peñas Coloradas, but by FARC's orders, they have to go to a doctor and get a checkout for sexual transmitted diseases. So they have to do it every Monday. They go to this doctor. They go to this doctor ordered by the FARC. The doctor does a checkup, sends samples to Florencia far away on a boat, and he gets them back like 2-3 days later to see if the women are healthy enough to work next weekend on these two bars, no?
But this is amazing. It's formalizing an economy through coca paste. So what does the doctor do with the coca paste? Does he then take it to Florencia to sell it?
No, the doctor gets paid with his little bags of cocaine paste, you know, and he keeps them. I mean, this guy would keep the bags in his like desk, you know, his drawer. And then at some point, you know, the dealers will come down the river again.
And when he does, the doctor just go and sell it. Instead, the prostitutes go and sell it to the dealer. It's just now the doctor or the storekeeper or whatever, you know?
It's amazing. And, but you see, I'm thinking of like a medical course here. You know, these are expensive at university in Colombia, unless you go to like one of the public universities. But this is an expensive course. This could be a doctor, let's say, educated at one of the top universities, who's down there doing his rural, you know, his like experience work. It could be one of the top, you know, clinicians or doctors of his day. I mean, do you know the doctor? Don't say his name.
No. I met the doctor, and this doctor is very funny because he was a FARC. But the first time I met him, he told me, "I'm FARC guerrilla, but I refuse to go to live in a camp full of mosquitoes, and I love my technology, and I have this kick-ass TV set here at my house, and this sound system." So he was like an incredible, well-trained doctor in London.
Ha!
Surprise.
There you go.
Surprise. And this guy had a clinic in the middle of the jungle, middle of nowhere, and I saw him performing like very hard surgeries, like bullets in the stomach, which is very hard to get out, and he did. And he told me once, "I can do like, how you call it, like brain surgery here in this clinic." Super well equipped, little shack, wood shack in the middle of the jungle. Inside, all the tools he needed.
This guy trained in London.
Yeah.
Wow. And is he? Would he be, let's say, the child of a former high-ranking guerrilla to have got over there, or is he just actually from a good family in Colombia?
It's not basically a family that I was like a family. I think he was from Bogota, middle class, you know, worked hard to give his kids an education, and it's a leftist, politically talking family, you know.
Yeah.
So the kids went to university. The two brothers are doctors, and they both trained in London.
Amazing.
But they were from the left, and they saw what was happening here in Colombian history, and they decided to join the FARC. One of them stayed in London. He's still in London. He decided to stay as a doctor in London. The other one came back and joined the guerrillas.
I just find it fascinating because it must be known to the authorities who he is and what he's doing, and it's long. This proves a long running theory that I've had, that people here just hide in plain sight.
Yeah,
you know, he's still operating.
This guy was caught once, and he told me he was like badly tortured, badly, and then somehow, you know, by the log leeches, whatever, he got out, went back to the guerrillas. And then when Plan Colombia started on 204, he had to run. He had to disappear from that area. And then, like, let's say in 2011, I ran into him in another place, and he was hiding.
Yeah.
And then he was caught again.
Yeah.
And then probably because of all this guerrilla deal with the government, he might be out, I think.
Yeah.
He was in a jail in Florencia.
Really?
And I think he should be out now because of the peace accord.
Yeah.
And if not, he's very close to get out.
Wow, incredible. I mean, that's the story behind this image. It's incredible. Now, moving on, because this book, I mean, this is amazing. It's kind of a testament to the lost war on drugs, you know, the whole Nixon thing. But we move on to our 30-odd pages, and you've now brought it into the urban environment, and you've got pictures here with local gangs in Medellin, and here you've got a picture with, he's got the regular blender on the floor, and they're I guess they're cutting it with, I don't know, talcum powder and aspirin and stuff. I mean,
they were cutting with lidocaine and caffeine.
And caffeine.
1 kilo, they made 3.
Wow. And you know, I mean, look at it. And there's nothing. They're not wearing. I mean, this guy's not wearing a mask. So he's presumably getting high off it, breathing in the fumes.
Yeah, this, I don't know what exactly happened there, but you know, you blend these three powders, cocaine, lidocaine, and caffeine, dry, you know? And as soon as you finish mixing up, this guy would like top up the lid and just like go with his nose into this like cloud of drugs, you know? And he would I mean, in the end, you see the size of the room. In the end, we're like all super incredibly high, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, next day I couldn't remember how to get to that place again, you know?
How do you organize getting involved with this? Because these guys are not friendly.
No, that was organized by a guy I met in Medellin, who was a guy that was very poor from one of his neighborhoods, and he was a gang member and all this stuff, you know. And then one day in his life, he decided to open this local NGO to help these kids.
Ah, okay.
So he contacted me with them.
Yeah, no, I just find it interesting because, I mean, I always think of the don't get high on your own supply type thing. But, you know, this kid, I guess he probably, you know, another victim of the violence in Medellin now.
It's just the dust, you know. Yeah. I mean, he's not spending any of the real money the one you pack in the little bag, you know, in the dime bag.
But amazing, and a tiny room, as you say. And then, of course, we move on, and you've got a picture in Chile, where you're from, the sexual nature of the cocaine trade. It's a party. You've got a quite terrifying picture in Buenaventura with a gang, the guy with his gun on the table. I mean, these places are, and we've got some pretty horrific images, some dead, people recovering, people, I guess, mourning, you know, with the news that one of their family members has recently been killed. And then we get to, like, you can see it's Mexico because of the style, the clothing. I assume she's a prostitute, I don't know, or...
She was a narco-corrido singer.
Okay.
She's out in this club. She's out in the parking lot waiting for her turn to go up on stage. But you see behind her, there's like a big Humvee.
Yeah.
And to get her, I went to the Humvee because I wanted to talk to her outside the Humvee.
Yeah.
But I get into the Humvee, open doors, and I get in, and they're all doing cocaine, you know, inside this Humvee. And I'm like, hey, you think, can I take a picture? And they're like, get out of here. So she comes out, and she explained to me why the type of music, I mean, we were talking just specifically about music, and she sings something, it's a music from Durango, which is a type of narco corridos, not exactly narco corridos, but they're all celebrating this, you know, this.
She has a photo in her hand, again, secondary. Who is this? This is the guy that sponsors her?
No, you know what? It's like, I took this picture, I never knew she had the picture on her hand, and then once I developed the picture and printed, I found out the photograph in her hand.
Yeah.
At the moment, I never knew.
Incredible.
I didn't see that.
So it makes me think a lot. One of my good friends, she does like some of this this music theory stuff. When we were in San Juan de Losada, all they listened to were narco corridos down there. All of it.
And San Juan de Losada in Caquetá,
Yeah, on the border of Caquetá Meta.
Yeah.
That's a horrible place.
I've been there once.
I had to spend 4 days there. I think it was last year. I spent
one night there and we ran.
I got flea bites and everything. I mean, it's just a horrible town in itself. Yeah. And then since I've been there, three of the people we spoke to have since been killed in, you know, in this wave of paramilitary killings and stuff. So,
yeah, they told me paramilitaries are getting.
Oh, yeah. The military are there, they've got their presence, but then at night they go back to their place. You know, it's as simple as that. So when we go, we're in Mexico here, and I guess you're in La Reynosa, right on the border.
Border with Texas.
Yeah. Oh, that's a horrible town.
That's horrible.
I mean, how often do you have to go to La Reynosa?
We went there for, in like 3 years, we went like three times.
Ugh.
And the last time we were chased out. We ran to the local airport to get the hell out of there.
Because I've spoken to a friend who works for one of those, you know, executive security firms, international, and he had to go to La Reynosa. And the security that they have to put on for themselves, not just the people that they are looking after, it's just crazy.
It's a very, very violent time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was lucky. I met this woman once and I start talking to her and then we talk more. I invite her for lunch and one day she says to me, look, man, here, the Gulf cartel, they're friends. You have nothing to fear. And I was like, oh my God. But then, in the end, I still was chased away, basically. I mean, I had guys follow me on the streets on walkie-talkies and saying, yes, patron, the Chilean left, or the Chilean is doing this. After 5 days, we were like, okay, that's it. We're not able to work, really.
No, and then, it's just been terrifying. Now we've moved on to the Bronx. And you get this Viet Bronx, it says here.
It's amazing.
And you've got these shelters. I guess these are the real down and outs. Again, like I said in the beginning, under the bridges, injecting in the snow. So we've taken the full circle of life of the coca plant. So from its most pure at the beginning of the book to its most dangerous, most bastardized form here. I mean, do you have to pay these guys to take their photos?
No, this kid, it was incredible because I worked on that place they called The Hole. It was like abandoned tracks in the South Bronx. And one day I was alone, just standing there, taking a look, see if something happened. And this kid shows up and I said, look, man, I'm working with this organization. I'm doing this study and this, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, that sounds super cool. Take my picture. And you know, next day I see the same kid and he's going down the hole to shoot himself up again. And I said, look, can we redo it, another session? And he's like, well, you know, I'm with these guys, it's not very comfortable on pictures, so let's pass. But I was like, super cool kid, you know, I explained the purpose of this work. And he was like, oh yeah, take my picture, please. Yeah.
Then you've got this guy picking up needles.
Yeah.
I mean, he must be with the foundation. He's doing it under the bridge in an obvious area where people must be shooting up all the time.
Yeah, people live on those tunnels and they sell heroin, cocaine in these tunnels and they use inside the tunnels.
No,
And this is like a guy who lives down in the tunnel, you know?
Yeah.
He's a drug user. And one day we went up with this organization to clean up, you know, to pick up syringes. And the guy comes up from the tunnel and says, look, there's some guys that are very high down there, could be very dangerous, so give me the bucket, I'll go down to pick up the needles, you know? Wow. Because these people trust very well these organizations, which are basically harm reduction, and they give up clean needles, condoms, so they get some respect on the streets.
He looks like a Central American gang member. I mean, he's got, I don't see the significant gang tattoos, but he looks like it. He's got the tattoo under his eye and everything. I mean, that you are with this organization gives you a massive, massive security blanket.
Yeah, you know, if you want to go to these places in the Bronx, it's better that you hook up with one of these organizations. And, you know, I'd be walking alone on the streets and someone would be like, why are you taking pictures? And I'm like, you know, I'm doing this work with Boom Health. And they're like, oh, you're with Boom, nice, go ahead, you know.
Yeah.
They have lots of trust. I heard sadly that they closed that organization like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they don't want to give them funds anymore for needle exchange. I mean, Trump.
But they've finished the needle exchange now, haven't they? It's now like illegal or something.
It was illegal in the beginning, and then it was kind of legal with federal funds, you know, and now with the Trump sessions. Yeah. Government, they don't want anything of that, so they merge that organization with one that is super well known for like zero tolerance.
Okay.
Because we don't want any drug users here, so why you have the organization, you know?
So, I mean, this is we've come to the end here, and let me just finally ask you, with this book that's on Kickstarter, that all of you out there are going to throw a few dollars at, Coca, The Lost War, La Guerra Perdida. What do you hope to achieve? I mean, this is a book that's taken you 18 years to do. You must have a plan for it.
Yeah, well, you know, I always thought this book had two angles. One is like, coca plants are sacred. I mean, they are revered by thousands across the Andes. And Wade Davis, who writes in this book, says very wisely, if you kill coca plants, you kill, you know, the way of lots of people, the way of living, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a very important plant that we need to preserve. And secondly, the war on drugs is really lost. I mean, we see it on this book. You see all the misery, you see all the pain, you see all the blood. So basically, I want people to look at this book and open debate. We need to debate on the war on drugs. We need to look for new alternatives. And, you know, legalization, there's millions of ways to go on a different way. Mm. This war is lost. Gone, so we need to debate and create alternatives. I think this is the point of this entire work.
Well, I think so. I think so. I am a big, I'm not saying legalization, I'm saying and there needs to be a greater dialogue. We need to all be thinking towards this. And this, of course, was the great, I mean, I hate to trivialize it, was the great disaster around the Secret Service scandal in Cartagena that year. When of course the Secret Service decided not to pay for the prostitution that they employed because Santos was going to debate the possibility of a dialogue around legalization. I am not a Santista, I'm not an Uribista, I'm not, but that was going to be his message at that moment. But everything, the news cycle got moved on, conspiracy or not, whether you like it or not, by the Secret Service. So, you know, we suffered from that. And now we're suffering from a different situation, a different political regime in the United States. But let me take this moment to thank photographer Carlos Villalón, Chilean, but really been here in Colombia for 18 years. I mean, a fixture on the photography circuit here, really knows his stuff. Do check out the campaign on Kickstarter. Do come down to the Ojo Rojo Fabrica Visual here in the Macarena. It's right on the Quinta.
Quinta and 27.
Yeah, Quinta and 27. So if you're coming to the Macarena for the cool bars and restaurants, it's right here. You might find him here along with another photographer or not, and they might share a word or might scare you off, whatever, but it's all good. But do get involved. And you know, this is an important project. That's why we've got it on Columbia Calling. So thank you, Carlos, for your time, and I wish you the best with this Kickstarter. I don't think you're going to have too much trouble, but...
I hope so. You never know. We'll see.
You never know. Yeah, but we'll talk about it later. Anyway, this is episode 227 of Columbia Calling, talking to Carlos Villalón, The Lost War, Coca, The Lost War. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling. Thank you for listening.